Welcome to the Deep Dive. Today we're tackling a really mind-bending topic, the way our brain actually works.
Yeah.
Specifically this idea that we kind of have two brains in one, you know, the left and right hemispheres.
Right.
And you're here because you want to get informed, get the real scoop, but without feeling totally overwhelmed.
Mm-hmm.
And that's pretty much our mission today, to make sense of this, well, incredibly complex organ in a way that's easy to follow. And honestly, pretty interesting.
It's a concept that's definitely been around, this whole brain division idea, and popular culture has certainly run with it.
Oh, for sure. Left brain, right brain personality.
Exactly. But what does the actual science tell us about these two halves and, you know, what they specialize in? That's what we're diving into.
Precisely. We've gathered our sources and we're looking at everything from like the basic architecture of the brain.
Building blocks.
Right. The building blocks. All the way to the really fascinating insights we've gained from situations where the connection between these two halves is, well, let's just say significantly altered.
Yeah.
We'll be exploring this concept called lateralization, how different functions tend to be handled more by one side than the other.
And what happens when that main communication link, the corpus callosum, is disrupted? It's pretty revealing.
And you can definitely expect some aha moments as we figure out how each hemisphere processes information in its own unique style.
Totally. From the tiny details to the big picture and how all that shapes our actual experience of the world around us, we're drawing on quite a range of research here. Brain evolution, anatomical structures, the specific jobs each hemisphere does.
And even some philosophical angles too, right?
Yeah.
On what this means for our sense of self.
Exactly. It gets quite deep.
So, okay, our goal for this deep dive is pretty clear. Unpack the core ideas of brain lateralization, hemispheric specialization, and leave you with a much clearer, more nuanced understanding of this incredible thing inside our heads. Okay, let's unpack this.
Let's do it.
So, to really get this idea of two hemispheres doing different things, we kind of need a basic map first, right? A general overview of the brain's structure.
That's a really good way to put it, like knowing the city layout before exploring neighborhoods.
Yeah.
So evolutionarily speaking, you see this development pattern. First, areas for just recognizing the world, then areas for processing emotions, and then, you know, the more advanced stuff like planning and decision-making.
Amphitically.
Yeah.
The sources talk about the cortex, that wrinkly outer layer.
Right, the gray matter mostly.
And the subcortical areas underneath, and the brainstem way down at the bottom.
Yeah, the brainstem is absolutely fundamental. It handles all that background life support. You don't think about breathing, heart rate, temperature, the absolute basics. Then you've got the limbic system, which is really involved in emotions, motivation, memory, kind of the drivers of our behavior.
Okay.
And finally, the cortex, the newest part, evolutionarily. It's divided into those four main lobes, frontal, parietal, occipital, and temporal. And that's where a lot of the specialized processing happens, like the occipital lobes at the back, crucial for vision, which, you know, connects to the right hemisphere's strength and visual stuff.
Yeah.
And there are other important bits, too, like the cingulate and insular cortex involved in things like emotion and self-awareness.
So it's this network of regions. And one of the big ideas, what our source calls maybe one of the simplest theories, is this idea of two specialized hemispheres lateralization.
Mm-hmm.
So why two? Why not just one big homogeneous brain? What's the advantage?
Well, it seems to boil down to handling competing demands. Think of it. Sometimes you need laser focus on details, right?
Yeah.
But other times you need broad awareness of everything happening around you.
Like scanning for danger while you're focused on a task.
Exactly. And you want to multitask without different processes interfering with each other. Plus, having some redundancy, two similar systems, offers a backup if one part gets damaged.
Okay, that makes sense. A kind of division of labor.
It allows for a more efficient setup and optimal compromise. You can move different sides of your body independently, perform different actions at the same time.
Like talking while gesturing, you mentioned.
Precisely. Non-conflicting functions happening simultaneously.
And the animal examples are pretty cool here. Our sources mention chickens.
Yeah, the chicken example is great. They can literally use one eye connected to one hemisphere to scan the sky for hawks.
Wow.
While the other eye, using the other hemisphere, focuses down, pecking for food, even telling the difference between grain and little pebbles.
That's incredible specialization.
It really is. And it shows how the environment shapes this chicken's raised without that need. Don't develop the skill as well.
Right.
And think about birds sleeping in a flock. The ones on the edge often keep one eye open.
The sentinel eye.
Yeah. one eye watching for danger, connected to an awake hemisphere, while the other eye and hemisphere get some rest. And many animals react faster to threats coming from their left side, suggesting the right hemisphere is maybe more attuned to spotting danger quickly. So it seems to be a widespread survival advantage.
Okay, so deep evolutionary roots for this two brains idea. But let's tackle the pop psychology version. You know, left brain equals logic, right brain equals creativity. Or those old male brain versus female brain ideas. They're too simple, right?
Oh, way too simple. They're popular myths, really, that don't hold up to actual research.
So what's the real picture?
It's much more nuanced. Our understanding comes from decades of studying people with brain damage, carefully designed experiments presenting info to just one side.
Like flashing images quickly.
Exactly. And using advanced brain imaging like fMRI, EEG, ways to see which parts are active. The idea that logic lives only in the left and creativity only in the right, it's just not true. Both sides contribute to pretty much everything, just in different ways.
And the sources mentioned specific methods, like the WADA test.
Yeah.
What about this?
The WADA test involves temporarily anesthetizing one hemisphere, usually with a drug injected into the carotid artery, to see what functions are affected. It helps pinpoint things like language dominance before surgery.
Whoa.
Yeah. Plus EEG, MEG, fMRI, those measure electrical or magnetic activity or blood flow to see the brain in action. And, of course, the commissurotomy studies the split brain research, which gave us huge insights.
We'll definitely get to those. But first, you mentioned the hemispheres aren't identical. There are actual physical differences.
Subtle ones, yeah, but significant. The right hemisphere, for instance, tends to be slightly larger and heavier overall.
Any idea why?
Well, interestingly, it also tends to have more white matter, the connections, the wiring between brain areas.
More long-distance calls, maybe?
Kind of. It suggests maybe more integration between different regions. Also, the front part of the right hemisphere is often wider and sticks out further forward. And a key groove, the sylvian fissure, often bends upwards more sharply on the right. Plus, certain areas in the parietal cortex involved in spatial awareness and attention are often larger on the right. So anatomically, it looks geared towards maybe more holistic, big picture processing.
And the left side. Different features there, too.
Yep. The back part of the left hemisphere is generally wider. The sylvian fissure on the left is typically longer by about a centimeter and straighter.
A whole centimeter. That's noticeable.
It is, in brain terms. Yeah. And crucially, key language areas like the planum temporal and Broca's area are usually larger on the left side.
Which fits with language being mostly left hemisphere dominant.
Exactly. The left also tends to have more gray matter, the actual processing units, the neurons, and even the neurochemistry is different. More dopamine, less noradrenaline compared to the right.
So maybe faster local processing on the left, better long-range connections on the right. Oversimplifying, I know.
It's a plausible way to think about it, yeah. More local processing power versus maybe broader integration.
That chemical difference is interesting, too. Okay, let's link this to something concrete. Language in-handedness. This seems like a classic example of lateralization.
Absolutely. It's one of the clearest examples. For the vast majority of right-handed people, we're talking like 96% speech is primarily handled by the left hemisphere. Very strong lateralization.
But it's different for lefties.
It's less consistent, yeah. About 15% of left-handers actually have language dominance in their right hemisphere. And another 15% or so show bilateral processing. Both sides are heavily involved.
Interesting. And the sources also mentioned something about differences between men and women here.
Yeah, research suggests that this functional asymmetry, for certain tasks at least, tends to be slightly less pronounced in women on average, maybe a bit more distributed across both hemispheres.
And this lateralization even affects our senses subtly. Like hearing speech better in one ear.
That's right. Speech sounds going into your right ear often have a slight advantage because they take a more direct path to the left hemisphere where language is usually processed. And similarly, recognizing complex shapes might be a tiny bit faster or more accurate if you see them in your right visual field because that info goes straight to the left hemisphere initially.
It's amazing how these subtle biases reflect the underlying brain organization. So why specialize like this? The sources suggest it might have actually helped our brains evolve faster.
Yeah, the idea is that specialization allows different parts of the brain to evolve somewhat independently. If a mutation affected, say, a language area on one side, the other hemisphere could potentially keep handling other vital functions.
Like a safety net.
Kind of, yeah. It provides some resilience. And you need that communication link, the corpus callosum, that huge bundle of nerves connecting the two sides, so they can still work together when needed. You get the benefits of specialization without total isolation.
Okay, that makes perfect sense.
That's...
And that brings us right to those split brain studies. Commissurotomy. This sounds pretty drastic. What was the story there?
It was drastic. In the mid-20th century, this was really a last resort for people with incredibly severe, debilitating epilepsy that medication couldn't control.
Just constant, massive seizures.
Yeah, grand mal seizures that were completely life-disrupting. The idea behind the surgery was to cut the main bridge between the two hemispheres, the corpus callosum, with its roughly 200 million nerve fibers.
200 million.
Massive connection. The hope was to stop the seizure activity, the electrical storm, from spreading from one hemisphere to the other and taking over the whole brain.
And did it work?
Remarkably, yes. It often did significantly reduce or even stop the seizures. And initially, people didn't always show huge, obvious changes in their everyday behavior or personality.
But it created this unique situation for researchers, right?
Yeah.
A window into how the hemispheres work when they can't easily talk to each other.
Exactly. With that main communication highway cut, each hemisphere could essentially process information and react on its own without the other side necessarily knowing what was going on.
Though you mentioned some smaller connections might remain.
Yes, that's important. These were patients with epilepsy, so their brains weren't normal to begin with. And often, smaller connections, like the anterior commissure, were left intact, allowing some limited information transfer. But still, the difference was profound.
So what did the experiments show? Walk us through some of the classic findings.
Okay, so one of the most famous setups involved flashing images or words very quickly to just one visual field. Remember, right visual field goes to the left brain, left visual field goes to the right brain.
Got it.
So if they flash, say, a picture of a key to the right visual field, sending it to the left hemisphere, the patient could usually just say, key, no problem. Language is over there.
Makes sense.
But T, if they flashed the key to the left visual field, sending it to the right hemisphere, the patient would often say they saw nothing.
Because the right side can't speak.
Exactly. The right side saw it, but it couldn't access the language centers in the left hemisphere to name it. But here's the kicker. If you then ask the patient to reach behind a screen with their left hand controlled by the right hemisphere and pick out the object they saw from a group of objects,
they could find the key.
They could often pick out the key perfectly. The right hemisphere knew what it saw and could guide the left hand, even though the speaking left hemisphere was completely unaware.
Wow, that's bizarre. Like two different streams of knowing.
It really is. It showed so clearly that the right hemisphere could perceive, understand, and act just non-verbally. Another clever one used compound words.
Okay.
Imagine flashing hat to the left visual field, right brain, and band to the right visual field, left brain, at the same time.
Okay, so at band.
Right. Ask the patient what they saw, and the left hemisphere pipes up and says band.
Makes sense, it saw band.
But then ask them to draw what they saw with their left hand, hidden from view.
The hand controlled by the right brain, which saw at.
Exactly, and they might draw a hat. But if you then ask them, what did you just draw? The left hemisphere, still clueless about the Ashik image, might have no idea or confabulate something else.
That's amazing. It really shows the independence. What about other senses, like touch?
Similar findings. Put an object, say a spoon, in their left hand behind their back. Info goes to the right brain. They could often use that hand to point to a picture of a spoon later.
And they couldn't name it?
Couldn't name it. And if you ask them verbally what was in their left hand, they might say nothing or just guess randomly. The right hand, controlled by the speaking left hemisphere, wouldn't know anything about the spoon.
So the information is just stuck on one side for certain tasks.
Pretty much. In one case, a patient could feel a clastic number with their left hand and correctly signal the number using the fingers of that same hand, while the left hemisphere was verbally making completely wrong guesses.
And drawing differences, too. You mentioned that.
Yeah. If they were asked to copy a complex shape, like a cube, and the image was shown to the right hemisphere, left visual field, they might draw a better overall representation, capturing the 3D form.
More holistic.
Right. But if the image went to the left hemisphere, the drawing might focus more on individual lines and details, sometimes losing the overall shape. It fits that idea of right brain seeing the whole, left brain focusing on parts.
And this could even lead to conflicts.
Yeah.
Like hands fighting each other.
Yes. Michael Gazzaniga, a pioneer in this research, called it bimanual conflict. He described patients where, say, one hand, controlled by one hemisphere's intention, would be trying to button up a shirt,
while the other hand is unbuttoning it.
Exactly. Following the intention of the other hemisphere. It dramatically illustrates potentially independent intentions when the communication link is down.
Which leads perfectly into Gazzaniga's concept of the interpreter. This is in the left hemisphere, right? What does it do?
So Gazzaniga proposed that the left hemisphere houses this interpreter function. It's constantly trying to make sense of our actions, feelings, and thoughts, creating a coherent narrative or explanation for why we do what we do.
Even if it doesn't actually know the real reason?
Especially then, that's the key. In split brain patients, they could trigger an emotional response from the right hemisphere, say, by showing it a scary or funny picture.
Okay.
The patient would physically react, maybe look startled or laugh, but the left hemisphere, which didn't see the picture, wouldn't know why the body was reacting that way.
So what would the interpreter do?
It would jump in and create a plausible story, a confabulation. If the right brain saw something scary, the left brain might say, oh, I don't know, maybe I felt a bit jumpy because that light flickered, or you startled me asking that question.
It just fills in the blank with a logical sounding reason.
Exactly. It has this powerful drive to create a coherent story of the self, to make sense of everything, even if it has to invent parts of the explanation. This really connects to what philosophers like Hume talked about, the self as a sort of story we tell ourselves, a bundle of perceptions linked together. The interpreter is the storyteller.
Those word-image pairing examples you mentioned illustrate this too.
Perfectly. Like the bell and music one. Flash bell to the right hemisphere. Ask what they saw. Left hemisphere says nothing. Ask what word is associated with what they saw. Left hemisphere might guess music.
Okay.
Then ask them to point to a picture with their left hand, right brain control. They correctly point to a bell. Ask why they pointed to the bell, and the left hemisphere interpreter jumps in. Oh, well, the only sound I heard recently was music, like maybe bells. It connects its previous guess, music, to the action it observed its left hand making, pointing to the bell.
It's rationalizing after the fact.
Totally. Or the banana example. Show banana to the right, red to the left. Ask them to draw. They might draw a banana with their left hand, right brain saw banana, using a red pen, left brain saw red. Ask why. Left brain might say, oh, red is just the easiest color to draw with using my left hand. It makes up a reason connecting the elements it is aware of.
So the left brain is the narrator, trying to keep the plot consistent even if it missed some scenes, while the right brain is more like just the facts.
That's a great way to think about it. Those probability experiments show this really well. Remember the flashing lights, 80% red, 20% green, totally random.
Yeah.
Animals and little kids just guess red every time they maximize their odds. Most adults try to figure out a pattern, even though there isn't one, and actually do worse.
Right, we overthink it.
Exactly. In split brain patients, if the task was managed by the right hemisphere, they tended to act like the animals maximized by always choosing red.
More rational, in a way.
More statistically optimal, yeah. But if the left hemisphere was in charge, it would often try to find a sequence, create a theory, look for patterns, even when told it was random. The interpreter wants a story, an explanation, not just raw probability.
This has huge implications.
Yeah.
What about something like moral judgments? How does this split affect that?
Well, research points to a specific area, mainly in the right hemisphere, the temporoparietal junction, or TPJ, as being really important for theory of mind. Our ability to understand that other people have beliefs, desires, and intentions, which might be different from our own or from reality.
And that's crucial for judging actions, right? Whether someone meant to do something.
Absolutely. Normally, we weigh both the outcome, what happened, and the intention, what they meant to happen. Trying to poison someone is bad, even if you accidentally use sugar instead of arsenic.
Right.
But Gazzaniga's work suggests that the disconnected left hemisphere, lacking easy access to the intention processing often happening in the right TPJ, tends to judge situations much more based on the outcome.
So accidental harm might be judged more harshly.
Potentially, yes. Because the left hemisphere interpreter might not fully grasp or weigh the it was an accident part processed on the right. Conversely, if someone had bad intentions but caused no harm, the left hemisphere might downplay the moral wrongness because the outcome was neutral.
Wow. So our integrated moral sense really depends on both sides talking to each other.
It certainly seems that way. The full picture requires integrating the what happened with the why.
Okay, this leads to the really big question. Consciousness. Mm. Is it all happening in the left hemisphere interpreter? Is that where I live?
That's the million-dollar question, isn't it? and probably much more complex than that. While the left hemisphere clearly handles the verbal narration, the running commentary of our conscious experience.
The inner monologue.
Yeah. It seems the right hemisphere isn't just unconscious automaton. It appears to have its own form of awareness, simpler, maybe nonverbal, but still a form of consciousness. Split-brain patients, remember, don't feel like two different people.
They still feel like oneself.
Generally, yes. They adapt, they learn strategies, their body is still one unit, they share sensory input, mostly, their eyes move together, emotions are largely integrated, the brain finds workarounds.
And you mentioned self-awareness might not just be internal chatter.
Right. Some theories suggest our sense of self also comes from observing our own actions and their effects on the world. And the current thinking on consciousness often involves networks across the whole brain, focusing attention on whatever is in our working memory at that moment. So even in a split brain, there's likely still some distributed processing contributing to a sense of awareness.
So not two separate conscious beings trapped in one head, but maybe a unified consciousness with some specific cognitive functions now separated.
That seems closer to the current understanding, yeah. It's not about two selves, but about how specialization impacts the experience of a single self when the main integration pathway is cut.
Let's dig a bit more into those different processing styles then. Left brain. Details. Rapid changes.
Exactly. The left hemisphere excels at analyzing sequences, breaking things down into components, processing fine details. And it's really good with timing processing information that changes quickly. Think about understanding speech. You need to decode sounds that change very rapidly. That's high temporal frequency. It's also good at high spatial frequency, sharp details in images.
And the right hemisphere. More big picture, slower changes.
Precisely. The right hemisphere is the master of visual spatial tasks. Navigating, recognizing faces, understanding shapes even if they're distorted, grasping the overall context or gist of a situation. It deals better with low spatial frequency, the broader outlines, the overall form, and low temporal frequency, slower changes, like the emotional melody or prosody of speech.
Prosody.
Yeah, the rhythm, the stress, the intonation of voice that tells you someone's asking a question, being sarcastic, happy, sad, the emotional tone. The right hemisphere is key for picking that up.
So it gets the emotional flavor and the overall meaning, like understanding metaphors or humor.
Absolutely. Those things often rely on understanding context and non-literal meanings, which seems to be a right hemisphere strength. But again, the crucial point is that we need both working together seamlessly for optimal function. They're a team.
A very well-balanced team, it sounds like. So back to evolution. Why did this teamwork, this specialization, develop? Any other ideas?
Well, besides resilience, some theories suggest specialization allows for faster processing within a hemisphere for its preferred tasks. Less interference, perhaps. If spatial processing is happening mainly on one side and language on the other, maybe they don't get in each other's way as much.
Concentrating resources.
Possibly. And there seems to be a link. As brains got bigger across evolution, they also tended to get more specialized. But that requires a robust connection, like the corpus callosum, to coordinate everything. It's a trade-off.
What about emotions? Do the hemispheres handle feelings differently, too?
It looks like it. Damage to the left hemisphere is sometimes linked more often to depression, catastrophic reactions, lots of worry. Whereas damage to the right hemisphere can sometimes lead to the opposite undue optimism, sometimes even denial of illness or disability, and anosognosia, a sort of inappropriate cheerfulness.
That's a stark contrast.
It is. It suggests the right hemisphere might be more closely tied into the raw processing of emotions, maybe especially negative ones, while the left hemisphere might play more of a role in modulating or interpreting those emotions. There was even a theory that the left hemisphere actively works to suppress or manage anxiety signals coming from the right.
That is fascinating. It makes me think. You know that feeling when something bad happens? And intellectually, you know it's bad, but it hasn't quite sunk in emotionally. Mm-hmm. That it hasn't hit me yet feeling.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean.
Could that be related? Like, the left brain gets the facts, but the right brain's emotional processing hasn't fully integrated it yet.
That's a really interesting thought. It's certainly plausible. It could reflect exactly that the left hemisphere's rapid analytical grasp of the facts, okay, this happened, preceding the right hemisphere's slower, more holistic integration of the emotional significance and the broader context. The feeling maybe arrives when both sides are fully online and integrated about the event.
Like the information needs to cross the bridge and resonate emotionally. Okay, there was also a simple test mentioned. Guessing which finger is touched.
Yeah, just a little illustration. If someone touches one of your fingers behind your back, you need the sensory info from that hand, going initially to the opposite hemisphere, to cross over the corpus callosum to the other side, potentially involving language areas to name the finger or spatial areas to mentally map your hand. It just highlights that constant crosstalk that normally happens without us even noticing.
So let's revisit Sperry's original idea. He thought split-brain patients might literally have two separate conscious minds. Is that still on the table at all?
Well, Sperry's work was groundbreaking, and it really raised that possibility starkly. But as we've discussed, the current view is more nuanced. While you can demonstrate independent processing in specific lab settings, the overall lived experience seems to remain unified, albeit altered.
Because they still share one body, one environment.
Right. Shared body, largely shared sensory input, synchronized eye movements, keeping visual fields mostly aligned. Integrated basic emotions. It's not like Dr. Jekyll and Mr. Hyde constantly battling for control in most everyday situations. It's more like a highly integrated system where the main internal communication channel for higher level stuff has been cut, requiring other, perhaps slower or less direct, ways to achieve coherence.
It's subtle. Now, what about those really extreme cases? People living with only one hemisphere or born without a corpus callosum?
Yeah, hemispherectomy removing one entire hemisphere is usually done in very young children to control absolutely catastrophic epilepsy originating from that entire side.
And they can survive that function.
Amazingly, yes. Especially when done young, the remaining hemisphere shows incredible neuroplasticity. It can often take over many of the functions of the missing hemisphere. Recovery can be remarkably good, though there are usually some permanent deficits, often in motor control on the opposite side of the body or in visual fields.
Still, incredible adaptability and being born without the connection. AGCC.
Agenesis of the corpus callosum. That's fascinating because outcomes vary hugely. Some individuals with AGCC have significant intellectual and cognitive challenges. Others seem remarkably normal, with maybe only subtle difficulties on complex tasks requiring interhemispheric integration.
How is that possible if the main bridge is missing?
That's the amazing part. Brain imaging in some high-functioning AGCC individuals shows that even without the corpus callosum, their brains seem to have developed alternative pathways, perhaps using those smaller commissures more effectively, or even developing unusual direct links, allowing the hemispheres to communicate and coordinate functionally. The brain reorganized itself during development.
Wow, the brain just finds a way. This really brings us back to those deep questions about identity and the self, and how philosophers have thought about this mind-brain connection.
Absolutely. Our sources touch on this historical perspective. You have Aristotle talking about form and matter being inseparable, maybe like brain structure and function creating the mind.
Okay.
Then Descartes famously said, "I think, therefore I am," focusing on thought, maybe like that left hemisphere inner voice as the core of being. But perhaps that view misses the more embodied, emotional, right hemisphere aspects of existence.
Right, it's more than just thinking.
Then David Hume suggested the self isn't a permanent thing, but more like a bundle of perceptions, constantly flowing and changing, linked by association. That resonates quite well with the idea of the interpreter constantly weaving a story from moment to moment, doesn't it?
It really does. A continuous narrative constructed from fleeting experiences.
And Kant argued that our mind actively structures our experience. We don't just passively receive reality, we shape it through inherent mental categories. Which fits nicely with the idea that the left and right hemispheres process the same sensory input in fundamentally different ways, creating different aspects of our subjective reality.
So philosophy and neuroscience are kind of converging on these questions.
Increasingly so. You had cognitive philosophy thinking of the mind as symbol manipulation, and now neurophilosophy and embodied cognition theories try to ground these ideas directly in brain function and our interaction with the world. It's a really dynamic field.
Okay, so as we start to wrap this up, what's the main takeaway from this whole exploration of our two hemispheres?
I think the biggest thing is appreciating the balance. Yes, the hemispheres are specialized. They have different strengths, different ways of processing the world. The two brains idea is a useful starting point for understanding that specialization, but they absolutely do not function in isolation in a healthy, intact brain. Our incredible cognitive flexibility, our rich emotional lives, our sense of a unified self, all of that emerges from the constant, dynamic, incredibly complex interaction between both sides. They are a deeply integrated system.
It really is an astonishing piece of biological engineering. As we finish this deep dive, it feels like understanding this interplay gives us such a richer picture of, well, ourselves, mm-hmm. our thoughts, feelings, maybe even our identity.
I hope so. And maybe it prompts you, the listener, to reflect a bit on your own experiences. Do you notice times when an intuitive right brain feeling clashes with a logical left brain analysis? Mm-hmm. Or can you catch your own interpreter in action, spinning a story to make sense of why you felt or did something, especially when the real reasons might be a bit murky?
Yeah, that's a fascinating exercise. Maybe a final thought to leave everyone with. If our brain, particularly that left hemisphere interpreter, is constantly building narratives to make sense of things, how much of what we perceive as objective reality is actually a kind of personalized construction? Mm. And does knowing about these two specialized communicating hemispheres make you feel more like a unified self or perhaps something a bit more complex?
That's a great question to ponder. There's definitely no simple answer. And if you do want to delve deeper into the science of lateralization or the philosophy of consciousness, the sources we used offer plenty more detail.
Well, thank you for joining us on this deep dive into the truly fascinating world inside our own heads.